projectile attack targets Saudi Arabia's oil terminal in the city of Jizan, resulting in a fire in one of the station's tanks. North Korea confirms its Thursday missile launch, describing it as a new tactical guided projectile. Also ahead, Brazil registers a record of more than 100,000 new daily coronavirus cases, along with nearly 2,800 more fatalities. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour: a fire has broken out at a petroleum products distribution station in the southern city of Jizan in Saudi Arabia. The kingdom's energy ministry said a projectile attack has resulted in a fire in one of the terminal's tanks. He added that no casualties were reported from the attack. Riyadh did not say who was behind the raid. However, it earlier said the Saudi-led coalition had destroyed several explosives-laden drones fired by the Yemeni army. The leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement says Israel, Britain and the United States are the masterminds behind the Saudi war against his country. Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi said Washington and Tel Aviv chose Riyadh to shoulder the costs and the responsibility of the Yemen conflict. He blamed Saudi Arabia and its allies for unknowingly following an Israeli agenda. Marking the sixth anniversary of the start of the Saudi onslaught, Houthi accused the Saudi-led coalition of deliberately targeting civilian gatherings and infrastructure. He said the coalition is paying terrorists to attack Yemeni people. Houthi also said innocent civilians are bearing the brunt of the Saudi-led war, which he described as an inexcusable crime. International calls have so far failed to stop Riyadh's devastating onslaught, which has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children. Political analyst Colin Cavell says the Yemenis have demonstrated that they have the desire and capacity to be free from the decade-long Saudi hegemony on their country.
The imperial aggression commenced in March of 2015 by Saudi Arabia and its coalition allies, its superpower hegemonic sponsors, the United States, the United Kingdom, and this was joined in by Israel. The Yemeni people have already demonstrated their desire to be free, of the Saudi puppets that they have put in control of their people for decades now. And they have demonstrated that not only do they have the desire to be free, but moreover, and more importantly, they have the capacity to be free. And it has come to the point where Saudi Arabia itself finds itself on the losing end of this relationship, and this has caused concern by their imperial overlords, the United States and the United Kingdom, who see Saudi Arabia as unreliable because they are losing control of the peninsula.
Meanwhile, human rights groups in France stage a gathering in protest against the country's continued arms sales to the Saudi-led coalition engaged in the war on Yemen.
The urgency at present is for France to stop these arms transfers to Saudi Arabia, to the United Arab Emirates, that it no longer contributes to the commission of crimes against humanity in Yemen.
The protesters accused France of complicity in the war on Yemen. The gathering marked 6 years since the start of the devastating onslaught against Yemen. Saudi Arabia is coming under growing pressure from the international community to end its military campaign. The new US administration has stopped sending F-35 warplanes to the United Arab Emirates over the issue. Some European countries, including Germany and Italy, have also halted or suspended arms sales to the UAE and the Saudi Kingdom. France is a major supplier of arms to the coalition, including fighter planes and missile guiding systems. A United Nations special rapporteur says a top Saudi official has issued a death threat against her for investigating the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. She published a 100-page report in June 2019 concluding that there was credible evidence the Saudi Crown Prince and other officials were liable for the killing. Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018.
Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Saudi Arabia initially denied any knowledge of Khashoggi's fate, as the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman told Bloomberg News that the journalist left the consulate shortly after he entered and that there is nothing to hide. However, recordings and other evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. In February, a long-awaited U.S. intelligence report also concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved and probably ordered the assassination of Khashoggi, but Washington stopped short of targeting bin Salman with financial or other sanctions. A report released in June 2019 by the U.N. Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard concluded that there was credible evidence that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other senior officials were behind Khashoggi's assassination and called the murder an international crime. Lately, Calamard has revealed she was threatened by the Saudis for her role in the Khashoggi investigation. She said a colleague alerted her that a Saudi official had threatened to have her taken care of. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, and Arbitrary Killings says the officials in the room had considered the remarks as a death threat. Calamard, who will this month take on her new post as the Secretary General of Amnesty International, had previously slammed the international community for their failure to ensure justice in Khashoggi's assassination.
Effectively, we see the United Nations is powerless because it is in the hand of the superpower, and particularly the United States, that has the veto decision on anything that goes against its own interest.
While a U.S. intelligence report in February revealed that Mohammed bin Salman directly approved the killing of Jamal Khashoggi in October 2018, the U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has failed to directly penalize the Saudi Crown Prince. Biden has rejected the idea of punishing bin Salman for Washington and Riyadh have an alliance. That's why Riyadh is the largest arms importer in the world. During the past 5 years, 24% of the U.S. arms exports went to Saudi Arabia.
A declassified U.S. intelligence report revealed that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, had ordered the gruesome killing of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Biden administration only announced sanctions recently and visa bans on the citizens involved in Khashoggi's murder, but stopped short of imposing sanctions on the Crown Prince himself. That is why the U.S. President Joe Biden rejected the idea of holding bin Salman accountable for the murder. He stated that Washington has an alliance with Riyadh and cannot punish its head of state. Indeed, Washington's alliance with Riyadh is a lucrative one. The U.S. has accounted for 37% of global arms exports in the world between 2016 and 2020, making it the largest arms exporter in the last 5 years. A major chunk of that goes to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the biggest arms importer in the world and alone accounted for 24% of total U.S. arms exports during the same period. Weapons, which have been used in Yemen war to kill thousands of innocent children and civilians, and caused the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States is protecting Saudi Arabia's violation of human rights and all genocidal crime that Saudi Arabia is doing, not only against the dissident, but also in Yemen.
The U.S. President Joe Biden has refused to penalize the Saudi Crown Prince, despite the fact that he promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for Khashoggi's killing and other abuses during his 2020 presidential campaign. While the U.S. benefits from its lucrative alliance with the Saudis, it seems that the green dollars have lured Washington to turn a blind eye to Riyadh's crimes.
Elsewhere, North Korea confirms it has successfully test-launched new developed tactically guided projectiles. Pyongyang said the launch of the solid-fueled missiles were overseen by senior official Ri Pyong-chol, who hailed the test as a significant move to bolster North Korea's military power. According to reports from Japan, the missiles flew 450 kilometers before landing in the sea, outside the Japanese economic zone. The United States has condemned the test as destabilizing. U.S. President Joe Biden earlier warned North Korea that Washington will respond accordingly if Pyongyang escalates its weapons tests. And Pakistan has shown off its military might with an impressive air show and display of high-tech indigenous weapons, particularly nuclear-capable missiles. Javed Ranam has more from Islamabad.
A massive air show in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The armed forces flexed their muscles on the eve of Pakistan's National Day. Pakistan celebrates every year the very idea of its creation in the name of Islam over 80 years ago, when this part of the world, together with India, was under the imperial rule of the British. The significant part of the air show was the acrobatic maneuverability of warplanes known as JF Thunder. Pakistan indigenously manufactured them in cooperation with China after the US stopped the supplies of F-16 fighter jets. Pakistan is fast reducing its reliance on the US for military hardware with the growing role of China in the indigenous production of its high-tech weapons with focus on fighter jets.
Pakistan is today manufacturing the JS-17, which has excellent capabilities and in a way is replacing the F-16. And if even the spares are denied to Pakistan, it seeks those from other countries or tries to manufacture it within Pakistan. The U.S. has many restrictions and sanctions. It's relying more and more on China and other European countries.
Pakistan had four wars with India, three of which over disputed Kashmir region, divided between two nuclear-armed neighbors in South Asia.
Pakistan is a strong nuclear-armed state. Beyond an iota of doubt, the peace in the region is linked with the fair solution of Kashmir dispute. We want to move forward with a desire of peace, but let me make it clear that our desire for peace must not be mistaken our weakness. Any misadventure against Pakistan would be responded back with a full force.
Kashmir dispute between two nuclear-armed neighbors have become a nuclear flashpoint after New Delhi refused to implement UN Security Council resolutions which call for plebiscite. According to a study by American think tanks like Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Simpson Center, Islamabad is far outpacing New Delhi in the development of nuclear warheads, and Pakistan would possess more nuclear weapons than any other country except Russia and US within the next 4 to 5 years. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The U.S. president says his country will likely not meet the May 1st deadline to withdraw all its troops from Afghanistan under a deal with the Taliban militants.
It's going to be hard to meet the May 1 deadline. Just in terms of tactical reasons, hard to get those troops out. So what we've been doing, what I've been doing, and what Secretary Blinken has been doing, we've been meeting with our allies, those other nations that have NATO allies who have troops in Afghanistan as well. And if we leave, we're going to do so in a safe and orderly way.
During the first press conference of his presidency, Biden said all of the remaining 3,500 U.S. troops will likely be pulled out of Afghanistan by the end of the year. Last week, the Taliban warned there would be consequences if the U.S. does not abide by the agreed timetable. The former U.S. administration signed the agreement with the Taliban last year. In return for the full U.S. withdrawal by May the 1st, the militants agreed to enter into peace talks with the Afghan government and commit to preventing Al-Qaeda or other extremists from launching terrorist attacks from Afghanistan. Turning to other news now, Brazil has registered a record daily increase in its coronavirus cases with over 100,000 new infections. The Brazilian Health Ministry also reported over 2,700 fresh COVID-19 fatalities. Brazil currently has the highest daily infections and death toll in the world by far. Overall, it has registered more than 12 million cases and over 300,000 deaths. It is only the second country after the United States to pass those grim milestones. The surge in infections has pushed hospitals and other healthcare facilities to their limits. President Jair Bolsonaro has come under mounting pressure over his handling of the pandemic. He has repeatedly downplayed the severity of the deadly disease, rejecting public health restrictions and lockdowns while speaking out against vaccines. EU leaders have stopped short of introducing a ban on the export of COVID-19 vaccines produced in the 27-nation bloc. This is while new data shows just over 4% of people living in the EU have been fully vaccinated. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU leaders have concluded the first of a two-day virtual summit, which was dominated by the bloc's highly controversial COVID-19 vaccination program. It was confirmed during the event that more vaccines have been exported from the EU than have been administered to the bloc's own inhabitants.
Companies have to honour their contract to the European Union before they export to other regions in the world.
So the EU's ban on vaccine exports, when deemed necessary, is going ahead. But critics say the damage has already been done due to the European Commission's mismanagement to date. The leaders' summit was given official data showing just 4.1% of the EU's population have been fully vaccinated. A third wave of the coronavirus is taking hold in the 27-nation bloc. Cases are spiking, most notably in France, Poland, Italy and Germany. Infection rate increases are being recorded in several other EU nations, including here in Belgium.
This means hospital admissions are rising. More are being transferred to intensive care units. The bottom line is people are dying due to the pace of the EU's vaccination rollout programme.
There's economic disaster looming for millions of businesses in the EU as new lockdowns are announced. In some nations, jobs are being lost at a record rate. The tourism industry is on its knees. Citizens are frustrated.
Our government was telling that it would be better in May and the opening of the cafes, restaurants and so on. And nowadays, I don't dare make a plan.
For the moment, the situation is so difficult that everybody's complaining about everything. And I understand that. It's not easy.
Critics say the health, social and economic consequences of the EU's failures during this crisis are not yet fully clear. Analysts warn there are likely to be dire political consequences for the establishment. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned. We'll be right back.
a diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Social media companies have a responsibility to protect children and young people online, but building a separate version of their platforms is not the answer, says Jessica Corbett, writer of an article published under the heading Deeply Concerning. Critics decry Facebook plan to build Instagram for kids 12 and under. Stay tuned for more of Jessica Corbett's article. Parents, child advocates, and big technology critics are responding with alarm to BuzzFeed's news reporting that Instagram, a photo-focused social network owned by Facebook, is planning to make a version for children under the age of 13, who are officially barred from both platforms but often able to access them anyway. It is deeply concerning that Instagram, a platform known for a host of troubling privacy, commercial and design practices that undermine adolescents' well-being, is now setting its sights on even younger children. Josh Golin, executive director of Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, CCFC, told Common Dreams website by email. If Instagram wants to do something for younger children, Josh Golin added, it should focus on getting under-13s off of the platform entirely. Rasha Abdul Rahim, co-director of Amnesty Tech, also expressed concern over the possibility of an Instagram designed specifically for kids. Facebook poses one of the biggest threats when it comes to children's privacy, Rasha Abdul Rahim said. Increasing safeguards for children online is paramount, but the fact remains that Facebook will be harvesting children's data and profiting off their detailed profiles. Social media companies have a responsibility to protect children and young people online, but building a separate version of their platforms is certainly not the answer, Rasha Abdul Rahim asserted. Abdul Rahim continued by saying, Facebook's very business model is built on ubiquitous and constant, which is entirely incompatible with human rights. By making users sign up to the opaque terms and conditions of Instagram, Facebook will be able to harvest huge amounts of data about children and create invasive, granular profiles that can last the rest of their lives. Even with an age-specific platform, she added, children will remain at risk of being bombarded with targeted advertising and incendiary content designed to keep their attention above all else. They will be left at the mercy of Facebook's algorithms and all too often amplified disinformation and divisive content in order to prioritize engagement. BuzzFeed obtained an announcement that Instagram's vice president of product, Vishal Shah, shared on an employee message board. I'm excited to announce that going forward, we have identified youth work as a priority for Instagram and have added it to our H1 priority list, wrote Vishal Shah. We will be building a new youth pillar within the community product group to focus on two things. A, accelerating our integrity and privacy work to ensure the safest possible experience for teens, teenagers, and B, building a version of Instagram that allows people under the age of 13 to safely use Instagram for the first time. Vishal Shah said that the work will be led by Facebook's Pavni Diwanji, who previously oversaw child-focused products at Google, including the controversial YouTube Kids. The internal announcement came 2 days after an Instagram blog post about protecting young people, which did not mention the new project. Adam Mosseri, the head of Instagram, will oversee the work. He told BuzzFeed that the company does not yet have a detailed plan for development, but knows that more and more kids want to use services like Instagram. "We have to do a lot more here," Mosseri said. "But part of the solution is to create a version of Instagram that young people or kids, where parents have transparency or control. It's one of the things we're exploring." The age 13 restriction on Facebook and Instagram traces back to the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA. As the Wall Street Journal detailed in 2019, Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, passed by a wide margin in 1998 and went into effect in April of 2000, 4 years before Facebook and 7 years before the iPhone. To this day, rather than go through the laborious process of seeking parental consent, most websites, apps, and social media platforms simply state that users must be at least 13 years old. Companies that collect or disclose data from kids can face civil penalties of more than $42,000 per violation, but they're liable only if they have actual knowledge that the person is younger than 13 years old, the Federal Trade Commission says. If a 13-year-old or younger child who lies about his age uses general audience apps and websites, this data can legally be collected and shared. Technology giants have come under fire for their treatment of personal data, and Facebook specifically for its surveillance-based business model. Some critics, such as World Wide Web founder Tim Berners-Lee, argue for more user control. As Tim Berners-Lee has said, "You should have complete control of your data. It's not oil, it's not a commodity." As Instagram for the under-13s crowd would not be Facebook's first foray into services targeting children, in December of 2017, Facebook launched Messenger Kids, which allows children under the age of 13 to exchange text and video messages with individuals approved by their parents. Dozens of advocacy groups led by CCFC responded to Messenger Kids with a letter to Facebook Chief Executive Officer Mark Zuckerberg, declaring that at a time when there is mounting concern about how social media use affects adolescents' well-being, it is particularly irresponsible to encourage children as young as preschoolers to start using a Facebook product. "Raising children in our new digital age is difficult enough," they added. "We ask that you do not use Facebook's enormous reach and influence to make it even harder."
Food for thought.
Salam everybody, and since today, the 11th of Sha'ban, is the birth anniversary of youthful martyr of Karbala, Hazrat Ali Akbar, peace upon him, let us present to you the words of his father, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, while sending him to battle in defense of Islam and humanitarian values. O Lord, be witness against this people that a youth is leaving who greatly resembled the prophet to the extent that whenever I was desirous of seeing my grandfather, I would look at him.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Abu Ja'far al-Baqir, peace be upon him, was asked about the most ascetic of all the people. So he, peace be upon him, replied, "It is he who pays no attention to the world." Then he was asked, "Who is the most hopeless of all the people?" "It is he who sells the remaining life for the transitory life," he replied. Then he was asked, "Who is the most important of all the people?" "It is he who thinks that the world is not important," he answered. IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. There are many beautiful conversations and dialogues which we find in some of the historical texts. And in one of these historical texts, we find an interesting conversation between Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, and his companions. And so in this specific conversation, in this golden dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam talks to his companions about how to treat people according to the rules of social conduct in Islam. One of the things that Imam al-Baqir talks to his companion in this dialogue, he talks about cheerfulness. And so Imam Baqir alayhi salam asked his companions and requested his followers to meet people with cheerfulness and good words. Imam al-Baqir at one point of the conversation says, "Good words and cheerfulness lead to love and nearness of Allah, while bad words, on the other hand, and frowning lead to hate and remoteness from Allah." In this very beautiful but very short and interesting conversation, we find that Imam al-Baqir was talking with his companion and he told him these two very beautiful things. One, that if we use good words in our conversations, and if we are cheerful, we are happy, we have a smile on our face, these things lead to the love and the nearness of Allah. But on the other hand, if we use bad words, we use foul language, and we frown all the time, then this, in fact, dear friends, leads to hate and being far from Allah, being remote from Allah. And so despite those days when we are just in a bad mood, or as they say, we woke up on the wrong side of the bed, we must try extra hard and be extra careful to remain cheerful and have a smile on our face, to use good words, to be kind to each other. These, my friends, are the beautiful lessons which we learn from Islam, and specifically in this dialogue with Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
One or two, you know, incidents from his life about his akhlaq, just to learn the seerah of the Imam, is the issue of, you know, sabr, patience in dealing with the people who are rude to you. And we see this example in the life of the Prophet, in the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen, in the example of Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, Imam Zain al-Abideen. But since we are remembering the fifth Imam, let us look at his example, where somebody, and it seems, you know, people had been brainwashed against the Ahlul Bayt. This individual was from Ahlul Kitab, either a Christian or a Jew, we don't know. And he was an Arab. We're talking about Ahlul Kitab from the Arab community. Knowing the Imam and his name and his laqab, his name was Muhammad alayhi salatu wasalam, but Baqir was the laqab, the title. So he knew that. So he comes and, you know, when he met him, instead of addressing him the way he is addressed normally, he says to him, "Anta Baqar." Baqar means a cow. And Baqir is very different. According to historians, Imam was lenient. He smiled at him and he says, "Maybe you have forgotten my laqab. La ana Baqir. I am not Baqar, I am Baqir." So this person continued insulting the Imam. And he says to him, "Anta ibn al-tabbakha." Remember, we're talking about the Eastern society, especially among the Arabs. To insult someone's mother is the crossing of the limit. But see how Imam deals with this situation. Then he says, "You are the son of a woman who works in the kitchen, tabbakha, who is a cook." Again, Imam does not, you know, he realized now this person is really after me, because he said Baqar and I said I am Baqir. Now he is talking about me as Ibn Tabbakha. Imam still looked at him and said, "Well, you know, at home, yes, she works in the kitchen. That's what she does as a wife and a mother. So what's wrong with that?" Imam doesn't respond or argue with him on that issue.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Hello and welcome back to The Light. A successful treasure hunt in China, archaeologists have made valuable finds in the country's southwestern Sichuan province. Researchers excavating the Sanxi Ju ruins have made new discoveries that help shed light on the eventful Chinese history. Some of the artifacts unearthed date back to over 3,000 years ago. Some of the most interesting objects include a 70-centimeter-long bronze ware and a ceremonial gold mask. More precious remains could be found there, as only 2% of the site has been excavated so far. In the latest round, over 500 artifacts were found. An Egyptian engineer has designed a robot to help frontline doctors do their life-saving work with more safety.
This robot is especially designed to help the medical staff during COVID-19 times. It is a medical robot capable of multitasks. It can deal with patients in their beds and help with chest scans, fever screening, and face mask detection.
Mahmoud's prototype robot is remote controlled. It can carry out PCR swab tests without causing pain. The robot is being tested in a private hospital for now, where it receives training to improve its artificial intelligence. Doctors say the ingenious invention has proven very useful so far, as it minimizes exposure to the virus. This Californian surfer is not famous for his surfing skills, but for his very special company on a surfboard, Pismo the Goat. The 80-year-old goat seems to be enjoying the waves a lot, even the very large ones. Dana McGregor, also known as the Goat Surfer, says he uses the experience for teaching children how to surf. He says riding with a goat on a surfboard has calming effects and will make children less scared of the sea and the waves. His students also describe the experience as fun and pleasant. McGregor started his goat surfing journey 10 years ago. What is the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear about a volcanic eruption in your vicinity? Of course, fear, chaos, or probably a plan to flee. But that is not the case with Icelanders. Thousands of curious onlookers flocked to an erupting volcano to marvel at the hypnotic display of glowing red lava. Iceland's Mount Fagradalsfjall began erupting late Friday after almost 900 years. Its lava bubbles and spurts from a small cone in a valley were seen piling up in a basin. It was a joyous moment for Icelanders, who are usually exhausted with chilly weather. Access to the site was blocked initially, but authorities then lifted the roadblocks under strict guidelines. The bravest of the onlookers found grilling hot dogs and marshmallows over the smoldering ashes. A Ukrainian fisherman saves the day with his biggest catch by fishing out an 11-year-old boy from an icy river. The boy said he didn't know how to swim and had drifted some 20 meters away from the shore on an ice floe while playing with his schoolmates. The fisherman threw his spinning rod to the boy and then reeled him in. Fortunately, the incident was noticed by two other men who were fishing nearby and came to help pull the boy from the water. The dramatic moment and the daring rescue from the Desenka River in Kyiv on Sunday was filmed by a fisherman and went viral on social media. And Japanese usually flock to natural reservoirs and parks during the cherry blossom season, which starts with the arrival of spring. But this year is a bit different, as coronavirus restrictions deter many to attend such festive gatherings. Flower viewing parties have been banned as the country is slowly re-emerging from a strict 10-week lockdown. Still, people are defying restrictions not to miss the floral spectacular, but of course with masks and at designated areas. Hanami, or cherry blossom viewing, is an old Japanese tradition. In normal years, the appearance of the delicate pink flowers is the cue for families and friends to spread out picnic blankets under cherry trees. Each year, it also draws many tourists from all over the world. A Colombian pianist has proved that animals enjoy music just like humans do. Maria Fernando Prado has created a relaxing atmosphere in a zoo in northern Colombia. He plays some of the world's most famous classical songs for animals. He believes that music brings peace and calm to any animal, from lions to flamingos. Zoo officials say the initiative is a wonderful experience for both animals and visitors. Of course, that's not the first time Prado does so. He has played the piano for animals in different places in the past. Now, the coronavirus may have shut down many social activities in India, but it can never stop the festive spirit of spring. This year, like previous ones, Indians are making preparations for the upcoming Holi festival, which starts on March 28th this year. This spectacular ritual runs for 2 days and is the second biggest festival on the Hindu calendar. When Holi arrives, people play with colors and try delicious local food. The celebration signifies the triumph of good over evil and is marked as a day of spreading happiness and love. Holi is also known as the festival of love and colors. Taking care of one's dental health is an absolute must, no matter humans or animals. A 14-year-old Siberian tiger has undergone a dental operation in a French zoo. The dentist took good care of the animal and even administered eye drops so that his eyes would not go dry during the procedure. Baikal broke his fangs 7 years ago while playing around, prompting the zoo owners to have her tooth revitalized and filled. The operation was successful, and the playful cat is now enjoying a brand new fang.
Now, while the world has been riveted by the adventure of NASA's Mars rover, a group of Swiss school children has been eagerly preparing their own mission to the Red Planet. The children have simulated a mission to Mars with the help of some space experts, including Switzerland's sole astronaut, Claude Nicoya. Their rocket is actually a bus with images of astronauts astride a spaceship. And their destination? Well, a Mars space station, conveniently situated, that is, in a secluded wooded area on the outskirts of Lausanne. In a bid to simulate a true space mission, all the children's meals consist of freeze-dried food and are put in an environment they don't know. The school principal says the experiment is aimed at validating what the students have learnt, including maths and science. Now, a volcano near Iceland's Reykjanes Peninsula erupts after being inactive for almost 900 years. The Icelandic Meteorological Office says the eruption was anticipated, though, following thousands of smaller earthquakes in the area in recent weeks. The office says the eruption posed no immediate danger to local people or to critical infrastructure. This comes over a decade after the eruption of another volcano in Iceland disrupted some 900,000 flights across Europe and forced hundreds of Icelanders to flee their homes.
It must be exciting to experience a real-world version of a game. Let's go to Japan to see what it's like to be Mario. Fans of the classic Super Mario games are delighted as Nintendo's first-ever theme park has opened in the western city of Osaka. Visitors can gather virtual coins and defeat villains while exploring the park with a smart wristband. One of the park's main draws is a Mario Kart ride around the castle of Mario's enemy, Bowser.
We perfectly recreated the world of the game. You can feel what it's like to be inside of the game and enjoy the life-sized world. You'll find piranha plants, and you'll see what it is like to be Mario.
Visitors can also meet life-size characters from the Mushroom Kingdom and grab a bite in Mario-themed restaurants. The attraction is part of the Universal Studios Japan Amusement Park. Its opening was delayed repeatedly from last summer due to the coronavirus pandemic. A Crimean powerlifter has set a Russian record for pulling a giant airplane. The powerlifter managed to pull an amphibian aircraft weighing 31.5 tons. He did so over the distance of more than a meter at a military base near the city of Sevastopol. The strongman suffered serious injuries during the first attempt on Tuesday when he pulled the plane for 31 centimeters. With the fourth attempt later in the day, he pulled it to 1 meter and 12 centimeters in just 40 seconds. The record was confirmed by representatives of the Record Book of Russia.
An archaeological team has discovered new ruins in Egypt. The discovery reveals a monastic life in the country's western deserts in the 5th century. The Egyptian Antiquities Ministry says the discoveries include ruins of three churches with graffiti and symbols on walls. It says the religious inscriptions and the Greek biblical passages prove the nature of life at that time. The mission was carried out by a group of French-Norwegian archaeologists. The find offers better understanding of the development of buildings and the formation of the first monastic communities. In recent months, Egypt has announced several major archaeological discoveries, hoping to revitalize its tourism industry.
That's a wrap-up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
They came to the King Super's grocery store on a grey Monday afternoon, fulfilling life's little missions. One woman was picking up a prescription. A retiree was fetching an online order for her side gig delivering groceries. A 25-year-old manager was at the front of the store, as always, happy to help. Then for the second time in less than a week, another workday American scene was shattered by a gunman's deadly rampage. This one more than 1,000 miles from Atlanta, Georgia, where families of the 8 people killed in another shooting spree are still planning funerals. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Jack Healy and Nicholas Bogle Burrows. The piece is titled, Boulder Shooting Survivors Describe Listening to Him Kill Everyone You Know. Stay with us for more of Jack Healy and Nicholas Bogle Burrows' article. They came to the King Super's grocery store on a grey Monday afternoon, fulfilling life's little missions. One woman was picking up a prescription. A retiree was fetching an online order for her side gig delivering groceries. A 25-year-old manager was at the front of the store, as always, happy to help. Then, for the second time in less than a week, another workaday American scene was shattered by a gunman's deadly rampage. This one more than 1,000 miles from Atlanta, Georgia, where family